Welcome to the Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. Mark Pettis. I'm with my friend, colleague, John Bagnulo. John, good morning.
Hey, happy Friday, Mark. Great to see you as always.
Happy Friday. Great to see you as well. In our last podcast, we reviewed an observational study that looked at this pretty powerful correlation between egg consumption and reductions over time of the emergence of Alzheimer's and cognitive impairment. And it gave us a context to explore it, in a bit more depth why protein is so important, why animal protein in particular has unique attributes that give it very important health considerations, despite, as we'll get into, what has been some general condemnation through the years that continues to this day. And then, you know, we'll look today, I think we can build on that by looking at this, the importance of lean body mass, how much of our body composition is in fact muscle, and why it's so important to be preserving, restoring, building lean body mass throughout our lives, especially given the challenges with aging that we see across the board. And so it seemed a good topic to build on. Well, so we'll talk about this phenomenon of sarcopenia, losing muscle mass. I've got a few slides to share, John, and a little bit of protein, but how does that sound to you this morning?
I think it sounds awesome. Couldn't think of a better way to start the day than talking about the value of animal protein.
And this really is pertinent as the USDA and the FDA, yeah, everyone is gearing up for the nutritional guidelines that'll be forthcoming over the next few months. And generally, when we look at the historical advancements of nutritional science, they really haven't brought us to a very promising place. I don't want to get too political or too critical, except to say that from a public health perspective, the guidelines have done nothing or little, if anything, to bend the needle on the epidemic of chronic complex disease. And certainly when you look at body composition as a predictor of those diseases, John, you can see how gaining weight more in the form of fat and losing the percentage of your weight that is muscle or lean body mass may be one of the most powerful predictors of longevity and quality of life. So I'm going to pull up a few slides if I can, John.
Yeah, you know, you said something there that's, you know, resonates. Nutritional guidelines and advancement, that's an oxymoron, right? I mean, it really doesn't take very many people in the right direction. And I think, you know, it's very sobering, Mark, to go back over the last 40 or 50 years and take a look at those and then look at the metabolic landscape. It's obviously not serving any population in the modern world very well. So yeah, it's a great, you know, I think sarcopenia, animal protein, animal fat, you just, whatever angle you want to take, you know, it's been maligned, you know, and now we're at a point in time, I feel, that we can really assess on many levels the very favorable influences that animal protein and in many cases animal fat will have on human health. And boy, it's, you go back 60 or 70 years, that's where, you know, I think things started really to take the wrong turn. You look at the way, whether it's red meat being lumped together with processed meat and then trying to draw connections to whether it's colon cancer or whatever it is, it's just, yeah, we're just at a point now where I feel like there's some light coming through. We're gonna, you know, I think we're gonna try to highlight some of those beacons of light that are coming through now. I know you and I both have researchers that were, you know, really, really fond of their work and the way that they are illuminating so many fallacies around animal protein. So yeah, let's take a look at these slides. I think it'd be awesome.
Yeah, and I'll go through these pretty quickly, and then we'll feel free to weigh in at any point, John, and then we'll bring this back to some conclusions and some important takeaways for those listening. All of this will be posted on our website, thehealthedgepodcast.com. There'll be the audio, the video. I'll upload some of the papers that we're going to be referencing, and as well as the PowerPoint slide deck. So for anyone who maybe is starting to feel like, I didn't quite catch what he said, they'll be, feel free to go back and look at this. We understand sometimes we can dive deep and quick. So let me just share my screen here. And I would hopefully you're seeing this okay, John?
Yeah, really clear. Thanks.
You know, I, this is this for me, and I know for you, is a good place to start because, there's so much research in the aging and longevity world these days. Fascinating. I think it's at the vanguard of life sciences as we really understand more about the distinction between biologic age and chronologic age and just how incredibly adaptable human biology is in response to environmental conditions. But despite all that sophisticated research, one thing that's held true, John, and continues in 2025 to be unequivocally proven by the literature, is that really there are just a handful of things today that would predict longevity and quality of life better than virtually anything else. One of these, which we're not going to talk about too much today, but I know it's an area of interest that you have, John, is this concept of MVO2 with exertion and more maximal exertion, right? How much oxygen you're moving in and out, which is really a marker of metabolic health and metabolic flexibility. And so that, MVO2 is a powerful predictor of longevity.
Yeah, within that, just quickly, again, maximum, VO2 max here, the maximum amount of oxygen one can consume. It's usually per kilogram of body mass. What's most fascinating about that, and I don't, like you're saying, I'm not going to go too deep here, but you look at all the components of that equation, left ventricular ejection, stroke volume, that's one of the three components to maximal oxygen consumption. Arterial and venous oxygen difference, which means, okay, how much oxygen can you extract out of capillaries, the capillary beds? That's huge because that's all about circulation, right? That's all about, having lean body mass in a way, because you're really going to only have high levels of capillary density in lean body mass. So it's connected there. And then, of course, maximal heart rate. It's an equation, Mark, that does capture some lean body mass, right? Muscles that are typically recruited in day-to-day life, as well as left ventricular ejection component or stroke volume. So it's got a lot embedded in it. But yeah, that's been one that over the last 30 years is it's held as a top tier evaluation of potential for longevity. It's a great one.
Yeah, and as you say, John, it really ties into lean body mass, right? How much muscle mass we have, which can also predict, it's not the same as, but it can also predict strength. And while our focus today is largely on protein, the nutritional components of that, all of this is further accentuated in the context of regular resistance exercise, where the combination of more protein and stress on that muscle group is what ideally leads to increases in lean body mass and strength. And so these are three really powerful predictors that and even if you're not able to measure your MVO2, body composition is easier to get measurements on these days, and even a simple hand grip, or how easily one can get out of a seated position to a standing position without needing to stabilize. There's some very easy ways one can assess these attributes of health. And I like to think of muscle mass, John, as sort of the metabolic retirement account.
Absolutely.
The
Yeah.
more one can deposit into that muscle group over their lifetime, the more they can draw from muscle mass, which, as we'll look at in a moment, is an important predictor of glucose or sugar management, of blood pressure, and again, metabolic health in general, weight, metabolism. These are all really the, one might say, they're the bullseye on the target of public health challenges these days.
Yeah, and the research on, lean body mass by guys like William J. Evans, who used to be at the Tufts Center for Aging. He was a physiologist and a gerontologist. It's a absolutely outstanding research that, to your point, highlighted the value of building muscle as early as you can and then maintaining that, into your 80s and 90s, and the value that that brought to people with disease risk reduction, quality of life, you name it. And then Butterfield was a researcher that, again, I minored in exercise physiology in both my master's and my PhD program. And Butterfield's name came up repeatedly as a real advocate for strength gains, strength training, even into, in your, like I said, late years, 80s, 90s, and how much that really improved the trajectory. These are, you and I are both big into nutrition, nutritional biochemistry, and that as an intervention. But it would be hard for me to, choose between someone getting into strength training on a regular basis, as opposed to, more focused on nutrition. This is a tough one to beat, really tough one to beat as a high level of return on your behavior change, right? You spend a half an hour a day devoting yourself to strength training. I don't think anything's going to match it, Mark.
Yeah, that's certainly the conclusions from, I think, all that's been published to date, John. And as you say, this research goes back generations, and for many reasons, modern life imposes challenges and environmental conditions that seem to discourage outcomes like this, from sedentary states to standard American diets, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a time where, my grandparents, great grandparents, they were stronger, they were leaner, they functionally could perform. You need to build something, you need to lift something, move something, grow something. There was a metabolically, you were prepared to meet that challenge. Today, I think it's fair to say much less so. And this is just to give people a sense of how sarcopenia is often looked at. These are CAT scans of mid quadricep, mid thigh muscles in the lower extremity. And when you look at the left, obviously all of this gray is muscle mass. And sarcopenia, as we get older, you see just this general atrophy. And all of this tissue here is fat. So we lose all of this lean body mass. It tends to get infiltrated and replaced by fat. And again, not to belabor the point, but this is a huge predictor of shorter life, diminished functional capacity, poor metabolic health, which equals increased risk for heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's. Most degenerative neurologic diseases are highly correlated with poor metabolic health. And so this, is a phenotype, a marker that predicts many things globally from a health perspective. We know that this is a becoming an epidemic worldwide, not just in the US. And this is a slide I may have gotten from you, John, at some point, but from a study back in 2020. And just as a it's a little bit technical, but The more fat we accumulate and the more atrophied our muscles become, this really sets up an inflammatory metabolic landscape. So we know that muscle mass, as it becomes more deplete, and it's so rich in mitochondria, which is essential to human health, and is a hallmark of aging, that mitochondrial function declines significantly. We're less able to handle oxidative stress, which our modern environments just overwhelm us with. And this is very important, John. We become more resistant to our ability to build lean body mass. So what we will see is that because of that, we require more protein than what the historical RDAs have been. And in much the same way, as we put on more adipose or fat tissue, we know that this can be very pro-inflammatory. So our immune system gets overactivated, and you begin to see this perfect storm of more weight, less muscle mass, poor metabolic health, and really it's your passport to accelerated aging and diminished quality of life. And that this slide sums that up pretty nicely. And I'll just keep moving forward here, John. This study that we were talking about before we got on here to record was published just a few years back. And it looks at this concept of metabolic health in Americans. And this is part of the NHANES. People that listen to us, I know, have heard us talk a lot about the National Health and Nutrition Exam surveys. This was one of the more recent cohorts that were followed. They looked at almost 9,000 individuals. And these are the criteria for superb metabolic health. And anyone who meets all of these criteria is probably on an amazing trajectory of quality of life and longevity potential. But basically, having a waist circumference of less than 40 inches of men and 36 inches in women, and the waist circumference, waist size, may be one of just the easiest measures that we can do, around the belly button, that sort of peak circumference, as fat in that area is a phenotype for inflammation and for sarcopenia. Blood pressures, a normal blood pressure without medications, optimal would be less than 120 over 80. A fasting sugar, less than 100, and an A1C, that many people are familiar with, less than 5.7. The triglyceride to HDL ratio, these are blood lipids that are in a standard lipid panel. And you notice cholesterol isn't listed here. Having that ratio, lower triglycerides, higher HDL, is an important biomarker of metabolic health. Not requiring any meds to achieve these outcomes. And this was in 2019, John. Only 12.2% of individuals met all five criteria. This is adults and children. And when you look at even more recent data, which I didn't have a chance to put up here, that number is now down to like less than 10%. So this is sort of the metabolic health trajectory that we are on. And this is pretty sobering data.
It's really difficult to fathom that 90% of the adult population in the US is compromised metabolically in one or more, multiple areas here. And it's, you just wonder what the future holds for healthcare capacity, et cetera. It's just, but that being said, that's the bad news. The good news is there's a solution. You just got to buck those guidelines that are forthcoming, typically. And
And
you
that'll
got
be
to.
a good segue, John, for where we're heading here. But yeah, this is pretty sobering. And this is this has all evolved right before our eyes, in the setting of trillions of dollars being spent in an effort to manage this. There isn't any business that wouldn't look at the data from what they're selling that is so poor and out of sync with what the mission may be, that wouldn't come to the conclusion that we need to totally rethink our business model.
Yeah, the CEO of this company would have been removed 10 times over, right?
Shareholders would have basically dumped the board, the directors. This is a company ripe for a buyout, and I while that may seem like a kind of a glib metaphor, it's pretty accurate. Despite spending lots of money and having a lot of intellectual capital out there, have really not put a dent in this. Something is not right. And so disrupted metabolic health, as we said, John, and the evidence is pretty clear. There are many sources now suggesting that this is an accelerated aging model of health and human biology, and one will have a much greater likelihood of multiple comorbidities, more medication, less functional capacity. What you see in our population currently is a manifestation of this metabolic trending. So it brings us back, John, to this sort of the initial reason for the podcast, looking at how much protein is really optimal based on some of these statistics. And I offer this study as one of many in recent years that has very much called into question the historical guidelines for protein intake, which have been 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram per body weight per day. That's considered kind of the floor. If you can get to that level, you're probably going to adequately meet your protein needs. The majority of people will have their protein needs met. That's the suggestion of those recommendations. And I think it's increasingly clear by many researchers, scientists, the American College of Sports Medicine, if you look at strength conditioning coaches and research in that field, it's quite clear that the protein needs that we have been woefully underestimated. And if one is looking to build muscle mass and to add to that metabolic bank account, they may require much higher amounts of protein, certainly much more than 0.8 grams per kilogram per day. And this was just the conclusions from this paper. And this came from the International Society of Sports Nutrition. These are really the evolving newer guidelines from some of these professional groups. And then a paper, John, that I think really opened my eyes is relates to not only have the RDA recommendations for protein been very low, there's been a kind of a myth, a meme in the exercise physiology, the workout folks, that only so much protein at any given time can be adequately utilized to build muscle. And anything above that amount is likely going to be just burned off or kind of wasted or, oxidized. And it led to this sort of suggestion that, beyond 20 to 30 grams of protein at any particular setting, you're not likely to derive much more value beyond that point. So most of that research historically has been based on protein muscle synthesis within, 4 hours after a meal. And certainly in that 4-hour window, protein muscle synthesis will slow considerably beyond that 20 to 30 gram of protein intake. This is very recent research by Dr. Luke von Loon that took humans and gave them a much higher amount of protein. It was 100 grams. There were a few different groups, but the group that got the highest amount of protein got 100 grams per day. And the amino acids were radioactively labeled, these isotopes. This allows them to really accurately track much more precisely how much of that intake goes into protein muscle synthesis, maybe other things, because building muscle is not the only metabolic need that we have. It's what we're focusing on. And what the old assumption was that only so much protein would be used to build muscle, and then beyond a certain point, extra protein would just be burned off with very little value. That has been the historical perspective from sort of a protein physiology standpoint. What Luke von Loon has found, and I believe other labs are demonstrating this as well, is that if you give more protein and you look at muscle protein synthesis beyond 4 hours, it would appear that you can continue to see increases in protein muscle synthesis for over 24 hours after a high meal, high protein consumption, and that the oxidation, very little of this extra protein gets wasted. Most of it
Makes
goes
sense
most of it
evolutionarily,
goes into
right? That
the
makes
amino.
sense. It
Exactly.
makes
Most
sense.
of it goes
Our
into the protein.
ancestors, yeah, our
Correct.
ancestors would have had much greater times between meals, right? And they, you might only get one protein-rich meal per day,
Right.
even as little as a couple hundred years ago, never mind 10,000 years ago. So the body's going to really prioritize the use of that. And look, I mean, this is the same thing I was taught. I was taught in exercise physiology back in the late 90s, that it was around 45 to 50 grams. Beyond that, you start getting into high levels of oxidation, So I was taught something a little bit better than the 25 to 30 grams and that kind of World Health Organization paradigm. But nevertheless, I mean, to look at 100 grams providing additional muscle protein synthesis, even into the next day, it's phenomenal. And I think it, I hope it opens eyes. I don't know how many clinicians, how many people that work with patients are really get to appreciate this. But Mark, it's a game changer to think about 100 grams as opposed to 25. That's, and then, with that, Mark, you start displacing a lot of the carbohydrates that we're trying to steer people away from. I mean, 100 grams of protein is going to provide satiety. It's not just going to provide this type of value in terms of building lean body mass and all the nutrient. I mean, the nutrient density of these protein-rich foods, they're almost unmatched, right? The minerals, the trace minerals, the essential fatty acids. So this really, it can take a person into so many very favorable directions when you start warming up to having not 3 ounces of animal protein, but maybe 6 or 7 or even 8. You start thinking about things that way. Boy, the amount of flour-based products and carbohydrates on your plate can drop dramatically. So it's just such a yeah, it's just such an important principle to try to really let sink in. Sorry.
That great, John, and particularly, in modern times, our amino acid protein needs, we have so much turnover. We're dealing with, 90% plus of people with compromised metabolic health tend to be more inflamed, tend to be more catabolic. They're breaking down. They can't build as, these are forces that interfere with those evolutionary adaptive mechanisms that you refer to, John. And so, I didn't put the slide up here, but his research and others have also shown that beyond protein muscle synthesis, lean body mass, this metabolic retirement account, right, this single greatest predictor of how long and how well you can live, is the extent that other metabolic needs seem to require more protein, more quality amino acids. There was virtually no wasting of of amino acids, no increased beta oxidation at all. So it does come back to this concept that we have metabolic demands that are greater now, in large part because of how our metabolic landscape has been undermined, by this modern environment that we're in. And so just some quick conclusions here, John, and then I'll get off the slides and we can just add some closing remarks. So the point is that this historical RDA of 0.8 grams per kilogram per day may simply be too low. For those that are losing weight, we didn't really, this is a whole nother topic, John, but we're in this era of GLP-1 agonist agents and a lot of people very effectively losing weight on these meds. Well, they're losing weight, but they're also losing a lot of muscle mass. And so there should be much greater consideration of how to adapt lifestyle and nutrition concurrently with use of these GLP-1 agents that would allow you not only to lose weight, but to try to preserve and mitigate loss of lean body mass along the way. So, this is not a once a week shot and you're one and done. One has to really, I think, look at this in a more thoughtful way. So, we probably need much more and closer to 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram per day as a target, just as a general target. In my view, the RDA should be more in line with this particular range. And then for those who maybe are more, looking to be more anabolic, looking to really build more muscle mass, strength, power, as high as 1.6 to 2 plus grams per kilogram per day of protein, it appears optimal, for anabolic responses, to overcome anabolic resistance, and all of the things that we're talking about. And that is an entirely different way of thinking compared to what has been the case historically. And then this is, I know, an area of research that you're very interested in, John, but we've just shown that higher amounts of protein in one sitting can give you enduring anabolic effects. But it's also important that, for people who are eating more throughout the day and that, you can be getting some protein with each intake is really important to assure that you're building that bank account. And so, we know that larger amounts of protein does not appear to be a ceiling or waste in any way. And then, sort of lastly here, animal protein, as we've talked about, John, is simply more complete with respect to anabolic promoting amino acid balance. These leucine in particular, the branched chain amino acids, methionine, these are all really important metabolically. And animal sources just give you the complete package. There's no questioning. Am I getting the right balance? Am I able to absorb and make use bioavailability? This is nature has packaged this in a remarkable way, and all of our ancient ancestors just inherently knew that. I mean, can you imagine, John, a hunter-gatherer around a kill, not eating to satiety, but just saying, I think that was 20 grams. I'm going to just, stop there. I mean,
Tribal chief, the
yeah,
tribal chief told me I should only have four forkfuls.
yeah, exactly, right? Try telling your carnivore, your tiger out on the African savanna to walk away from the kill after those first few bites because their protein needs have been adequately met. I mean, from an evolutionary biologic perspective, so much of what has guided historical recommendation is just off the mark. And so that's I think kind of a good synopsis. There's a lot more research, but we, there's I think we make the point here, John, that more protein is important. Spacing it throughout the day is important for that long overnight fast. Even getting a little more protein later in the day might be a good way to enhance ongoing muscle protein synthesis and anabolic regeneration through that long overnight fasting period. And we're just learning a lot more about our ability to handle and benefit from a different way of thinking about what's good for us and how much of that is best to serve us.
Yeah, absolutely. And 30 grams, I think, is especially for an older adult, 30 grams is the minimal amount necessary to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. I mean, this is stuff from the last 5 to 10 years from people like Elena Volpe and others. If you're under 30 grams of protein and you're over the age of 50, you may not stimulate muscle protein synthesis to any significant degree. That's important. The role of branched chain amino acids. That's huge, right? And those are very difficult to find in plant proteins. I mean, they're there, but they're not like they are in something like eggs or dairy protein, whey protein. Those are really rich sources. And those have incredible benefits for not just muscle protein synthesis and gaining lean body mass, but in other areas of health, right? They have a huge interface with our endocrine system. So I think there's a lot here to unpack for people. And I know that it's, again, it's hard when you've got 50 years plus of animal protein being maligned and being told there's a limit, that it's gonna harm your kidneys, it's gonna cause osteoporosis. I mean, we've heard all of that, right? All of that propaganda against animal protein. And look, I mean, going through a graduate curriculum like I did, right? American Dietetic Association at that time in the 90s, they had a curriculum where, boy, it's like the 0.8 grams per kilogram and anything beyond that is just expensive urine. I mean, that's basically the message we're taught. I mean, but all those guidelines, you look at the numbers of people that were involved in determining that as a target, daily RDA, so to speak. And then you look at the goals is to prevent things like kwashiorkor. I mean, it's not about a healthy aging trajectory. So the whole thing is, the whole thing is a paradigm that I think is slowly starting to break here for people. But lastly, I'll say, Mark, in addition to, telling our listeners to train more and to eat more, I mean, that's really the take-home message, right? Train more with your body weight, train more with weights, eat more animal protein. Is the role of potassium in all this? Because one thing that people don't understand about lean body mass is that it can be easy to build lean body mass with the right amount of protein and the right stimulus on major muscle groups for training, but it's an incredibly potassium dependent process, and muscle mass has a huge potassium component. So you got to make sure your daily potassium intake is up, because that's what is necessary to help build muscle and to maintain it, to keep it. So that's something we can talk about later. But eat your dark green leafy vegetables and get your carbohydrates from root vegetables and things like that are really high in potassium, yogurt, whole milk. But that's, the two together, wow, the synergy is incredible.
Yeah, beautiful, John. That's a great note to end on. Yeah, don't fear the protein from animals. Don't fear the fat. Cut out, eliminate the sugar and processed carbs. Derive your carb intake from root vegetables and low glycemic plant-based fiber dense sources, and stress those muscles. And I'm thinking, John, with our next podcast, we can review the supplement creatine.
Yeah, that'd be
Every
great.
now and then there's a supplement that emerges that just has more robust evidence than the crowd to really support many of these lean body mass and metabolic health goals. And creatine is one that really checks all the boxes. So maybe we can come back and look at some of that research
Brilliant,
and how
brilliant
creatine
idea.
kind of pick
Brilliant.
one supplement above and beyond them all to help guide this particular health goal. It would be creatine. So, John, great to Great to see you.
You too, buddy.
Great to share this discussion. And again, for others, please feel free to check out our website and share if this is content that's useful, share it with your friends. John and I don't we're pretty much inept from a social media perspective, and where we're not inept, we pretty much choose to avoid it. So we appreciate just the granular word of mouth, and that feels very organic and rich. And so until next time, John.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Great to be with you.